on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Actually, I'll tell you the story. The teacher said, we're going to paint pictures of lovely fish in a stream. So everybody did beautiful tropical fish, and I did this sort of muddy, you know, I was much more realist in my approach to art.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, that's not very good, is it? So ever since, for a long time after that, I thought, I am no good at painting. And then I picked up, you mentioned Carl Jung, and he has these four, what's the word? The four
personality types?
Yeah, yeah. You know, thinking, yeah. Feeling, sensing, intuition.
Right.
And what I worked out was that actually, if I paint, I need to give myself permission to paint badly and just to play with the colors. And so I started doing that. And then I started actually really enjoying playing with the colors. And so now I don't do it enough, but that's one of the things that I find, just playing with paint and with color, that really feeds my spirit.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Carlos Philip Glover to discuss his book, Earth Wisdom Teachings. Carlos shares his own spiritual journey, working with the medicine wheel, and the importance of reconnecting with nature. We discuss how our ecological crises reflects an internal imbalance and the need for a transformation of consciousness and the importance of hope, love, and spiritual activism. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Carlos Philip Glover has trained with teachers from different traditions, among them Ihama Institute of New Mexico, for more than 40 years. He is the co-leader with Wind Eagle of Evocative Leadership Mastery in Spain, and for more than 20 years has served as the dance chief for the UK Drum Dance. He is the founder of Earth Wisdom Teachings and joins me today to discuss his book of the same name. Carlos, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your time, and I'm very much looking forward to speaking with you about your book. It's one of those books that really resonated with me, and I think it's an important book. So I'm looking forward to getting into the details with you. But I thought first, if you don't mind, the book is largely informed by indigenous teachings. And I thought, if you wouldn't mind, that maybe you could share a little bit about your spiritual journey that led you to doing everything that you're doing now.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, I think I always had a sense of spirit, of the mystery as a kid. And then when I was about 16, you know, in your teenage, you become an intellectual. I decided I was an atheist and a hedonist, and the only point was to have as much pleasure as possible. And then some years after that, I went on a trip to Egypt, and I was so impressed with the temples there, and that kind of opened my mind. And yes, I've explored a number of different traditions, and I think they all have a lot of wisdom to offer us. For me, the reason I joined up with the Earth Wisdom Teachings was really the sense that it's also about our relationship with nature and the planet. And that's so important to me, because I'm very aware, been aware for quite some time, of the crisis that we're in terms of that relationship.
Yeah. I think it's probably the main idea running through the book is something that really resonates with me. I typically kind of frame it in the old Hermetic axiom as above, so below, but also refer to it as within, so without. And that the ecological crises that we're facing right now is a reflection of something internal in humanity. And I think that that is really what your book is trying to help us resolve.
The way that you worded it is that we're out of balance inside, and the effect of this is that the outside is out of balance.
Yes. Well, yeah, I think that's really important to explore that. And I mean, just to kind of to put it as briefly as I can, I think that as humans, our consciousness is quite complex. And we tend to, when we're awake, we're very much dominated by thinking. So our brain is thinking all kinds of thoughts. All kinds of thoughts are going through our head. And for much of my life, I was unconscious of most of those thoughts, just went along with them. But I think it's that we're dominated by thinking that makes us feel separate from each other and from life. And I think the antidote to that, I mean, there's a number of antidotes, and of course, I've talked about them in the book, but to really recognize that our consciousness has a number of different aspects. Thinking is only one of them. So sensing, I mean, how we touch life with our five senses, that's a different function. I know they're connected, but the brain typically interprets our sense perceptions. And our sense perceptions are really, they take place in the present moment. They have to take place in the moment, hearing, seeing, touching, so on. So that is a different function from thinking. And when we start to give more attention to our sense perceptions, then the thinking gradually becomes quieter. It doesn't, for most of us, it doesn't disappear altogether unless we're going into samadhi. But we notice more and more our thoughts really dominating. So I think part of our, well, what I really want to say is that I think if we're stuck in a sense of separation from life, then we have to compensate for that by consuming, by another bar of chocolate, by another round of shopping, by digging another mine, getting more money, and this extractive mindset. And really, a friend of mine, she put it like this. She said, "You can't get enough of what you don't really need." But when we come back into our wholeness by opening up our senses, by opening up all aspects of our consciousness, then we're much more in relationship with life, and we're actually being fed and nurtured by life. So we don't need to do all that consuming and extracting. So we're much more in relationship and in balance with life.
Yeah, I like all of that, and it is, yeah, we're very out of balance. And it's interesting because you hear often, and I've heard this for almost 40 years now, that we need to have a transformation of consciousness. And what I really liked about your book is that you take it deeper, I think, than just we need to think in have a different perspective. Is like you mentioned, there's the sensual aspect, there's the emotional aspect, there's a healing aspect, there's a dreaming aspect, there's a creative aspect to all of this. And I feel that that's so important because it seems, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like we have this idea of self, but our idea of self is woefully inadequate, that we are much bigger than what we think we are.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with that. The way I see it is that we do have like a little self. So, and we need that. And, it's the self that when we're getting on a plane to go abroad and we show our passport and they say, "Who are you?" This is who I am. You just show them your name, you're English, British, or American, or whatever. And they say, "Fine, you can go." But the mystery behind that, really remembering that we are part of this much bigger. And I think we can remember that by remembering times. I think probably everybody has peak experiences where they felt bigger and more connected, maybe looking at a sunset or in some beautiful place or really absorbed in an activity. And then if you remember those moments that are not ordinary moments, when we have an extraordinary sense of ourself and of the life force that's keeping us alive, and we remember that actually we're part of this whole universe, really. We're an expression of the universe. So I think that really helps. I
Yeah.
mean, I was out in New Mexico. I have teachers in New Mexico, and I'm sitting out in the desert there. I'd spent a couple of days out there, and just looking up at the sky and seeing this myriad of stars. And I just felt this awe. And then there was a shooting star, just kind of right as I was looking at it, it just fell through the sky in silence. And those kind of moments, you just feel so much more expanded. And I think all of us have those.
Yeah, New Mexico is a wonderful place for that. I love to go down to New Mexico because there's so many open spaces where there's no light pollution and you can actually see the Milky Way. And I recently had a conversation with someone that is along those lines. They sent me a video of one of the telescopes, deep space telescopes, where they're trying to create this sort of map of what we know of the cosmos. And there was just like this little sliver, and it just kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper, in time. And there were all these galaxies and whatnot. And my response to it was that we often hear that when people have this confrontation, like with the night sky, that they feel insignificant. And that is not what I felt at all, looking at all that, because the feeling that I had, it wasn't, I wouldn't frame it as a bigger sense of self, but it was the sense that I am participating in this mystery and I am part of this mystery, that the universe and I are kind of one. So, in that sense, yes, it's a bigger sense of self, but it's also abandoning that little sense of self.
Well, we need the little sense of self to operate in the world. I mean, we
Right.
do need to take care of that side too.
Yeah.
But to have the connection with the bigger expanded sense, it gives you so much more resource and you feel much more confident and connected from that.
Yeah. 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 And we are, I think that's one of the main drivers of our, the crises that we are facing now is that we are so disconnected. And it seems to me that this is something towards the end of the book, you were talking about desecration. And I'm going to read, this is what I have here from your book. Respect for the external reflects respect for the internal. Respect for the planet means respect for the person. Learning to honor the personal and the planetary go together. Our desecration of nature has been caused in part by dead matter thinking. Desecrate literally means to take away the sacredness. And the note that I added to that was that I think part of this is that we've stopped seeing ourselves as sacred.
I wasn't taught to see myself as sacred. I was just a tiny little bug, unimportant, just a kid to be educated at school.
Yeah. But it seems that it's that sense of awe that helps drive us to not just that bigger sense of self, but a sacred self.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize the sacredness and to almost intend to see our own sacredness and the sacredness of other people, however they're behaving,
Right.
however they're presenting, to try and remember that underneath that there is a huge story. Everybody has a huge life story behind it and all their experience and so much. And even though they may be behaving, in an appalling way.
Right.
We all do it sometimes, we
Right.
lose it, we're
Yeah.
human. But if we think, well, you look at the sun and I mean, what a boggling thing that is. I mean, we get used to it. It's there all the time, just the sun. But I mean, you can't even look at it without, burning your retina. And it's just an extraordinary thing. And it's 93 million miles away. That's a long way, but still, it's really, really close, and we're part of that. So it's mysterious, and it's kind of, if that's sacred, and the earth is sacred, and then you start thinking, well, the plants and the animals are sacred. So what are we humans? We must be part of this as well. So I think when we come back into that sense that, life, it's sacred, and to see everything in a way as a gift. Can we open our mind to see everything as a gift? And then we're more awake to really, really appreciate it.
And the other thing in connection with this, I kind of want to go back to this idea of consciousness, because when we see everything as being sacred, don't we also recognize that there is consciousness not just within the human, but throughout the entire cosmos, I suppose?
Well, definitely that's the way I see it. And when I started writing this book, I was really struggling in a way to think, well, how do I express that in a way that doesn't sound really woo-woo? Because the dominant paradigm is that actually consciousness is something that emerges from human beings, from our brain, from the adult human brain, and that when we get old, we start to lose it. So I think that's kind of a different definition of consciousness. And the way I'm using it in this book is to think of it as like the ground of being, that it's everywhere. And I think that's an easier way of understanding life, and it actually shifts everything when you see it like that. And I mean, I look at my dog, look into her eyes, and you can't really tell me she doesn't have consciousness of a kind. So then it starts to expand more and more, and you start to see things that we were conditioned to think of as dead matter, like rocks. I mean, it's a more of a stretch to see them as conscious, but maybe they're like ice compared to flowing water. Maybe they're slowed down so much, but I hold that they too have consciousness of a kind.
Yeah, the way that I've always understood this is that the more complex something is, then the more conscious it is. So the human brain is fairly complex. So we have this, incredibly complex consciousness. Dogs, have consciousness. Cats have consciousness. Probably not quite the same as human, but it's hard to say. But insects would have consciousness, and plants have some kind of awareness. So we find it everywhere we look.
Well, I read something very interesting this morning, and somebody's been doing experiments on rats by tickling them. They tickle these rats, and apparently the rats do giggle. They can measure the giggling of rats when they're tickled. And it gets to a point where they can measure, even when the person who does the tickling walks into the room, they start giggling in their own way. I thought that was really sweet to read that.
That's very interesting. And if you're a lab rat, that's the kind of experiment you want to be a part of, I think.
It's a better one, isn't it, than many?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm going to ask you this question. I had someone ask me recently, in regards to a lot of what I'm doing with the podcast, why focus on the spiritual? And kind of the criticism was, there are a lot of people out there that aren't spiritual, but yet still care about the environment, still care about the ecological crises. And I'm from the perspective that we have to have a kind of spiritual resolution to this, that we can't ignore the spiritual. And I was curious what your thoughts are on that, and how might you respond to such a question?
Well, we do need to care for all parts of ourselves. And in the Earth Wisdom teachings, we think of ourselves as having different aspects: spirit, emotion, body, mind, and we need to care for all of those. And they interact. They're not separate from each other. So what does spirit really mean? I've wrestled with that for a long time, and it's difficult to really define it. But I think of it as that part of me that is connected with all spirit. So the spirit of the universe, that I'm part of that. And obviously my physical body is not as separate from your physical body and from the things around me, but my spirit is connected with all things. And it's mysterious whether people are spiritual or not. I think of it like this. I say they're either spiritually minded people or not. But I hold that everybody has spirit. So I do think there's something about the spirit that makes sense to me to open up to that. And it's kind of opening up to the mystery of life. And if you start questioning, I mean, that's really what scientists do, is question deeper and deeper into the mystery to try and understand what this is all about. But when you take a glass of water, we think of, well, it's just water, and that's okay. You just drink your water. But when you really think about it, well, what really is that stuff, that liquid stuff? And you really sit with it and quest into it. Well, H2O, does that really explain what it is? I mean, so I think it's opening up to those kind of questions of when I talk about mystery and spirit.
Yeah. Well, and I think that what science tells us is that, I mean, when we look deeply into matter, it's mostly empty space. It's not what we think it is necessarily. And you quote or just tell a story of Max Planck in the book, who kind of argues that there is a consciousness behind all of it.
Yeah, I think so. And you asked me at the beginning about my own journey. I think there was, I just remember hearing some songs in, I was a student in the 70s, and there was something by The Doors in which they talked about the universal mind. And I can remember thinking about that phrase at some point, and I thought, oh, that's a very interesting concept. Because I didn't, before that, I didn't really think there could be anything beyond the personal, the individual. But just having that kind of thought, thinking, well, maybe there is something. Maybe that explains telepathy and all these things that actually, and you had a very interesting guest not so long ago who was talking about the group fields of energy. And I think that's really important to bear that in mind, that we are individual, but we're also part of a group field. And you can observe that when you're in a crowd, that we affect each other, and the crowd has its own energy, really. It's like when you watch flocks of birds. We have these amazing flocks of birds here, starlings. Can be thousands of birds, and they're swirling around like a cloud, and they're kind of dancing, and apparently they never even touch each other, and each bird is part of that dance, and they're all, there's nobody particularly in charge of it. They're all making it up as they go along. So I think we humans also have this collective consciousness. So that's an important thing to think about.
Isn't that the flight of birds? I am trying to remember. Isn't that referred to as like a murmur?
A murmuration.
Murmuration. Yeah,
Yeah, if
I know
you
it's
want
close. Yeah.
to Google it on YouTube, murmur, MURMURATION, and you'll see some amazing videos of it.
It is incredibly amazing. And the idea of a kind of a collective consciousness makes sense to me because I also am a huge fan of Carl Jung and the idea of a collective unconscious. And it seems to me that if you have a collective unconscious, then there's going to be a collective consciousness as well.
Yeah, that's right.
And I can also say that Yeah, you're absolutely right in terms of large groups of people, at like sporting events or concerts, and there's a feeling that you can pick up on. But even in smaller groups, as an instructor, one of the things that I always say is that every class has its own spirit because all the individual people come together, and it may be, 25, 30 students plus me, but each one of those classes has a unique feel towards it. And it's really interesting to try to interact and work with that.
Well, it is extremely interesting because, when you're leading that group, you need to receive the energy as it is. You don't want to just, conflict with it, but you kind of need to sense it and yield. Well, I use the word yielding to allow it to come in. Sense how is this group today, and then what do I need to bring? Because you're definitely the one who's probably having more influence on it. So what can I bring? And in my training, we learn to think before, before walking in, how do I work with my own conscious energy? What kind of energy do I want to bring in? And just to pause for a moment, take a few breaths and think, actually, I have all potential here. I can call on different energies that are needed to bring more wholeness and more understanding, more balance. So I think it's a really interesting subject.
No, I agree. I think it is as well. And I'm trying to figure out how to work better with that energy in the classroom.
Yep, we can always, this it's an ongoing journey, isn't it?
It certainly is. Well, let's kind of dig in a little bit deeper to your book, because what you're doing here is it's all based on a medicine wheel, or the idea of a medicine wheel. And I was just curious if you could, for anyone who may not know what that is, if maybe you could discuss what the medicine wheel is. And how one can, and this is a big question, how one can work with the medicine wheel for their own inner balance and to improve our ecological situation.
Great. That is a huge question.
It is. So
Thank
go.
you. Go. Well, medicine wheel, if you think of a circle, actually, probably if you think of a stone circle, we have Stonehenge, we have Avebury, we have many stone circles in this land. And of course, there have been stone circles in North America. And how people used those in the past, we don't necessarily know. But if you think of the medicine wheel as a circular design or pattern, and when you have one on the earth, it's like a sacred space. So, of course, the whole earth is sacred, but you're consciously stepping into that circle and seeing it as a sacred reflection of who you are. So, in a way, the medicine wheel can best be understood as a mirror of creation. All creation is there, and it reflects back to you. So if we step in with that kind of attitude, then we're open to perhaps seeing something more about ourselves and about our wholeness. And how to work with the medicine wheel? Well, of course, in the book, I talk about a lot of different teachings. In the lineage of earth wisdom that I carry, and it's only one lineage, by the way, all the teachings are arranged in this circular pattern. And some of them are about the human self, some of them are about groups of humans, how to self-organize, some of them are about the structure of creation, some of them about the cycle of the seasons, many, many different wheels, but they kind of correspond to each other. If you lay them on top of each other, you see correspondences and you start to get insights. So I mentioned earlier, one wheel is about the human self and it talks about the spirit, the emotion, the body, and the mind. And if we care for all those four aspects of ourselves, then we're bringing ourselves into more balance. Sometimes we spend a lot of time in our minds or some people spend a lot of time just in their body, not taking care of their mind or their emotion. We need to care for all four aspects, and that helps us to come into balance. So that's just one wheel. Just, but
Okay.
I'll pause there and see if
Okay.
you want me to, where you
Yeah,
want me to go next.
so if I understand correctly, it's a kind of a layering of wheel upon wheel upon wheel.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Yeah, and what I particularly enjoyed about the approach that you took is in terms of creating the circle, I always thought about it just in terms of the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. But you added four others, which I thought was really interesting. And I thought that that also added so much to this idea of a medicine wheel. And so, how would someone, let's say someone reads your book and they're like, yeah, I like this. How would someone begin working with the medicine wheels?
Well, okay, I'm going to take it that they've read the book. So there are some clues in that already. And what they could do would be to actually lay one out. Perhaps in the yard or, even in the house. It doesn't have to be huge stones. I've got some here on my windowsill. They could be little stones like this, and just to lay them out in a circle. But do that with mindful attention. Don't just, it's not just a casual thing, but just to be really, really there and present with it. And then to notice how the different aspects of the wheel work with each other. So the thing about the circle is it is a symbol of wholeness and a symbol of infinity. There's no end to it. So the wheels are really showing, the medicine wheels are really showing how different things work together to make wholeness. They're not really separate, but we can tease them apart to see how they interact. So that would be one way. And they you could create an altar, for example. You could have a little table, maybe you put a nice cloth on top of it, and you lay out your stones in a circle like that. And maybe you bring precious things that are meaningful to you, you put those on the altar. Maybe you put them in different directions. Typically, we would put the fire in our lineage, the fire would be to the right in the east, where the sun rises. The earth would be opposite that in the west. The water would be in the south. And the air is typically, we place that in the north. Of course, they're everywhere. But to put them on a wheel like that, you could put symbols of those four in the four directions. And then maybe if you have it like that as an altar in your house, you take time to sit with it when you can, or, when you're doing your spiritual practice or consciousness practice, sit with it and go deeper into it. I was speaking to somebody recently who really had no teaching about the medicine wheel, but she intuitively, listening to the stones, she ended up creating one.
Very interesting.
So it's a
And
big question. You've asked me a big question. I'm trying to answer it quickly.
yeah, no, that's okay. Answer as in-depth as you would like. I was just curious. In the book, you do give a lot of practices for someone,
Yes.
and I found them all very valuable. And I guess the when I was asking how someone would work with this, when they create the circle and maybe they make one, it can be how you describe one. Maybe they're sitting in the center of it or a small one on an altar. It seems like the first step is just to go in and sort of feel and see, because I don't think it's like you said, the circle is there's no beginning and there's no end. So it's not where someone's like, well, today I'm going to work on the east and tomorrow I'm going to go, southeast. But it seems like they're maybe an intuitive kind of knowing will tell them this is the place that you need to begin.
Well, you can do what you just said. You can say, I'm going to look particularly at the east today, about my connection with the sun, the stars, and my all potential, my infinite potential. I'm going to hold that in my consciousness. and see how that affects my day. So you can do that. You don't have to look at all of them. There are many, many different ways of working with it, really.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I was just kind of curious how someone would kind of begin doing the work.
Well, one thing I would say is it's helpful to, when you step into that space, to do a ritual action before you step into it. And, it could be many different things. It could be making the sign of the cross is one for Christians. In Islam, there's the wudu, washing different body parts, cleansing different body parts in turn. You could wash your hands as you before you step in. There are different ritual actions, but do something mindfully that's meaningful to you, and that kind of creates an energetic space from what you've been doing before. And then you step into that space, energetic space, and you start to explore it. I take a copy of my book, and there might be a practice in there that just appeals to you.
Yeah. And I'm trying to, since I've read the book, I'm also trying to ask questions that will get people interested so that they can kind of pursue it as well. Because I know some of the answers to the questions I ask. I'm just trying to
I
get,
had a feeling you might.
Well, there's a couple things that, I wasn't going to go through each of the eight directions because that would be a little bit tedious, but there were a couple of ideas that I really liked and I thought that we could maybe chat about for a few moments. One is, and this is towards the end, and I've heard this before, and it was in relation to Mohandas Gandhi, and it's the idea of satyagraha, which is translated, I think, as soul force, but I've also seen it as truth force. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about that a little bit and what this means and how this can also be applied to the individual and the group, I suppose.
Well, I'll say that Gandhi, as a kid, I had my heroes were like warriors, and then I became a bit more rebellious and it changed. But then there came a point where I saw the film of Gandhi, and I had Gandhi as my hero for a while. And I write about him as an example of using the heart mind, because the heart in our lineage is also a mind. The mind isn't just up in the brain. The heart also has a lot. It's not thinking, but there's a knowing and a decisive intelligence to our heart. And when we connect with it, it actually creates a tremendous force field. So I don't know that Gandhi necessarily spoke about this in his, or wrote about it in his writings, but he did definitely employ that heart energy, which is loving, but it can be quite fierce love. And it's a power that mobilizes our own energy, but it also starts to mobilize the field of energy. Like you were talking about the walking into the class, when you can actually really activate people through your own heart. And some of the great charismatic te speakers, you look at, I'm thinking of John F. Kennedy and Churchill, they were coming through their heart, and people heard that energy. And it started to awaken other people's heart. So, and Gandhi was a great example of that, because he achieved this amazing revolution in India, getting the British imperialists out without a huge spilling of blood, persuading them, it's time for you to go. We love you. We want to part as friends. But it's time for you to go, and we will look after ourselves. We will rule ourselves now. And just sends me shivers as I say that, to remember that.
Well, it,
Tremendous.
yeah, it, re it seems to me that acting out of that soul force or truth force is a really good place to ground one's activism. also grounding it in love in terms of trying to affect change, because there is a fight of sorts that we have to engage in. And if we take a violent approach, I don't think it's going to work. We've got to act out of, I would say, our higher selves.
Yeah, I really agree with that. And I think what's important is that we also care about the opponent.
Right.
If
Yeah.
we're just treating them as the opponent that needs to be wiped out, we're just repeating the same thing. We're just kind of trying to kill the enemy.
Right.
It has never worked, really. Yes, there've been changes of government and so on, but we now need to actually try to care about the people who we're trying to convince.
Right.
So there's a loving attitude to it, but as I said, it's a fierce love. So there needs to be a saying, well, underneath it, we care about you, but what you're doing is wrong and it needs to stop now. And I think that combination, it's not the easiest combination, but I think that is what is going to work
Yeah.
and actually is working. And I know people who've used that. Well, just talking about Gandhi. So
Right.
we're on an ongoing, it's an ongoing shift of consciousness and evolution of the way we're living on this planet and living together.
Right. Yeah, and it seems to me that, speaking from the United States, we are so polarized right now, over here, and there is this tendency to demonize the other. And that is not going to lead to anything good. We need to, I think, embrace a little bit of love and some of that good old-fashioned brotherly love that we, it's supposed to be the foundation of the republic, is love for one another.
And really, democracy is about talking about our differences. Okay, you see it different to me. Tell me more. I want to really understand what's behind what you're saying. What is your anxiety that's behind that? What's your concern about that?
Yeah.
Please tell me more. And then by asking questions, you can draw people out. And then maybe you say, well, I see it a little bit differently. But there's a dialogue there. And if there is no dialogue, then you end up using weapons. So democracy is all about conversation and speaking.
Yeah. Well, as you wrote in the book, there is wholeness in diversity.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and it seems like that there's strength in there as well.
There's a strength in there. And I think it also goes back to approaching things with this sense that I'm not just a little separate self, I'm also part of something much bigger. And so is the person over there. We're both part of something bigger. And if you have that kind of attitude, then I think you're opening the space. I mean, I've struggled with this myself. I'm not saying I've got it cracked, but and I have my political views and they differ from many other people. But we need those other views to have wholeness. We need to open to that. There's a validity and a wisdom in those other views as well.
Yeah, well, and I mean, in terms of diversity, we think in terms of the human population, but even within ecosystems, the more diverse a ecosystem is, the more it can flourish.
That's right. We're open to diversity in nature. We love it. But then we have people who move in next door and we don't like them. How could they be like that? So we need to learn to open to each other and not be afraid just because we're different.
And along those lines as well, you also wrote that peace is not the opposite of war. It's the resolution of these polarities through the deepening of that relationship.
I think peace has a lot to do with our consciousness. Can we come into peace consciousness? That's what the book is really pointing us towards, because we'll be a lot more effective from that perspective in whatever we do, really.
No, I agree. And I struggle a little bit. You kind of suggested the same thing at the beginning with kind of the language of sometimes, evolution of consciousness. And, the philosopher in me is always, well, what does that actually mean? But there does have to be some kind of change. And I think that that's probably the best way that we have of trying to resolve all of this. One of the other things that I appreciated in the book was you had this section about how we react to things. And I saw this connected to these polarities that we find ourselves in, because people have this tendency, it seems, to react from a very emotional place and maybe from that small self rather than responding in a loving, caring, gentle way.
Yeah, I think I know in myself it reacting often it comes when I'm feeling a lack of space inside. When I'm trying to do too many things in too short a space of time and I'm feeling stressed and pressured. And there's a fear that I'm going to run out of time or so it, that diminishes my inner space and I need to keep coming back into the present moment. Remembering my breath, remembering this moment. And then that inner space, it expands. So I'm much less likely to just be driven into a reaction. And if I have an inner reaction, I've got the space to actually say, hey, you know what? I just need to speak about something here. And you can speak about it in a way that doesn't trigger the other person.
Yeah, there's a big difference between reaction and responding, I think.
That was one of the things I really wanted to bring out.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job with that. And it was one of those things I'm like, oh, yes, this is something that I need to remember as well.
Yeah, well, me
And
too. This is also for me. I need to practice what I preach.
Well, and that's the, I think that's the thing with works like this is that it's an ongoing practice that, you did not come across as, look, I've got all the answers and I'm a perfect person. That it's like, these are the ways that, this is what works and this is what's worked for me. And these teachings are grounded in often indigenous teachings and there's great value to them. But it's something that we're always having to work at. And, one of the things that along this line of responding and reacting that kind of clicked with me, and I didn't know why it has never clicked before, but there's this analogy that's often used in by Buddhist in terms of meditations with thoughts. And it's like, well, just treat the thoughts like little clouds and, don't dwell on them. Just let them flit away, float away. But you added something and that I was like, oh, that's it. Because you noted, it's like you are not the clouds. Your consciousness is the sky. And I thought that was amazing because it was something that I often forget.
Well, it's so easy to forget, and we identify with the clouds, with the thoughts, and
And it seems that when we identify with those clouds, that's when we react rather than respond.
we get caught and carried away by them. Yeah, that's what they want. They want our attention, like in the middle of the night. You wake up and your brain starts saying, you've got to think about this right now.
I know that
Why
very, very
now?
well.
Why now? Can't we wait until the morning?
Yeah, I'm getting better at that. I'm able to go back to sleep now a little
That's
bit,
great.
but it's still, I don't know. The human brain is a weird thing, I think. It's another
But we
mystery.
can learn. As you say, we can learn ways to manage it and to manage our con well, not manage, but actually we use the word command our state of consciousness. So when the brain starts getting busy, I feel using the breath, deepening the breath is one way, and also putting our attention into our body, because the body also has mind, it also has consciousness. So just feeling inside the body, what does it actually feel like? The sense of aliveness within the body.
And I know there's a Buddhist exercises along those lines where you check in with the body. And I think that's one of the things that is part of this shift in consciousness is that we have this ongoing sort of duality of mind body and see them as separate. And some people are like, well, no, it's just the body and kind of disregard the mind. And it's like, but it's both, it's mind body. And we can't ignore one in the service of the other.
That's right. Actually, in the lineage of teachings that I carry, we have 10 minds, or in the full phrase, the old teachers, they called it energy, mind, consciousness. And we have 10 of them, not just the brain. And of course, they're constantly interacting. They're not separate from each other.
Well, and that seems like it's how in the West we would think of, mind, body, spirit.
Say some more about that.
Oh, just energy, mind, consciousness. I was thinking in terms of mind, body, spirit. I would connect spirit with consciousness in some aspects, but also, and this is something that you said at the very beginning, about this question of, well, what do we mean by spirit? And the way I always think about it is that it's the life force itself and that it is flowing through us. And it seems to me, I'll just throw this comment out, that so many of us feel that that life force has been deadened somehow and that it's not able to flow in the ways that it ought to flow. And I think that that leads to a lot of aggravation and anxieties and is probably part of the problems that we face. But yeah, mind, body, and I think that you can make a connection with body and energy, perhaps, because there is the energetic channels within the body as well. So that's how I was kind of thinking about it. And I know that that's also something that you find in, especially in the Indian religious systems, this idea that there are three kind of subtle kind of energies between mind, body, and consciousness. I don't know that they go as deep as 10, maybe.
Well, they have chakras, so there is a sense that these different I can't really talk about chakras, but we have these different energy centers in our body, and
For sure. The other thing that I wanted to kind of ask you about is kind of where you begin in the book is in the East and with creation. And in creation, this is where you really talk about that sort of energetic aspect of life. And you noted that the creation energy shines through our words, our thoughts, and our deeds. And I'm curious because it seems to me maybe this is what I was just kind of getting at is that the spirit, and if I equate it with life force or creation energy, that seems to be kind of stopped in many people, that we don't feel free in our lives, it seems.
Well, I think this is really important to think about and to feel into. And if our spirit is not as bright as it could be, what would feed it? And how are we deadening it? What is stopping the flow? So to really notice that, and sometimes when we're doing the same thing over and over again, and we get bored, of course, our spirit energy drops. I think we also need to watch what we're thinking about, because certain thoughts will also deaden our spirit. So many of us, we grow up and we feel we're inadequate in some way, we're not enough. Now, that kind of thought is going to dampen our spirit fire. But we can find ways to feed it in activities. Like, I love looking at actually looking at the stars. In winter, I see more of them, or sitting with a fire, or painting. When I was at school, I got the impression I was no good at painting. Actually, I'll tell you the story. The teacher said, "We're going to paint pictures of lovely fish in a stream." So everybody did beautiful tropical fish, and I did this sort of muddy, I was much more realist in my approach to art. And it was like, oh, that's not very good, is it? So ever since, for a long time after that, I thought, I am no good at painting. And then I picked up, you mentioned Carl Jung, and he has these four, what's the word? The four,
Personality types?
thinking, feeling,
Feeling.
sensing, intuition. And what I worked out was that actually, if I paint, I need to give myself permission to paint badly and just to play with the colors. And so I started doing that. And then I started actually really enjoying playing with the colors. And so now I don't do it enough, but that's one of the things that I find, just playing with paint and with color, that really feeds my spirit. So we need to find things that will feed our spirit. And also, as I say, not to dampen it with the kind of thoughts we're allowing ourselves to think, thinking
Yeah,
that we're not good or
the limiting beliefs.
limiting beliefs. Yeah.
And I think the challenge is, in many cases, is the world that we live in that doesn't necessarily allow us the freedom to explore these things often. And that's where a lot of the work, I think, has to come in, is changing everything or most things, how we've structured our society so that we can have more freedom to express our deepest spirit and creativity.
Well, it's needed. Everybody has something unique to express, but we need to listen deeply to our spirit to see, well, what is it? What is my unique gift to life? And how am I going to bring that?
So I know that we're kind of running out of time. Unfortunately, I've got to run to teach a class, but I have a question that I often ask people when we are having conversations about, especially about the state of the environment and the ecological crises that we're facing. And that is, do you have hope?
I do. I remember I listened to you interviewing Stephen Harding, who was a friend of mine. He wasn't sure about hope. The reason I choose to be optimistic is because I think our thoughts are extremely important, how we think about the future and the possibility. And if we close that off, of course, we're affecting our own energy. But we're also affecting what happens. So I think it's really, actually, I feel passionate about this, that we need to remain hopeful without being blind to the destruction that's going on, but to actually to dream the possibilities and to hold those kind of images because the images of ecological harmony, people getting human beings getting it together. And I talk about this a bit in the book, but when we start to dream like that, we're already creating something. It may not happen in our lifetime, but it's already there and we're kind of fetching it to us. So that's why I'm passionate about hope and optimism, not blind optimism. But I think it's important because it really affects our energy. And when we go in, and I know despair. I've been an environmental campaigner. I've known the crisis. I've shed many tears about what's been going on. But to be honest, I was a campaigner in the 1980s, and I really, at that time, I really did not think we'd be sitting here in 2024. And the world would still be more or less doing the kind of things we were doing then, I thought it would either fall apart or we would already have transformed. So there's been a kind of miracle that's happened. And I know the situation is grave and we need to wake up. We're being challenged to wake up. And maybe because of this crisis that we've created, we are at a turning point. I want to hold that as a possibility. Holding on to the possibility is really important rather than closing the door, because we are shaping the future with our thoughts.
Where we put our attention is kind of what will come about, it seems.
Yeah, that's right.
And I always like to think in terms of hope married with courage.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we
So,
need our courage. That's
oh
right.
yeah, we do. Well, and courage, as you note in the book, the root of the word in French is heart.
Yeah,
You know,
that's right.
need to start acting from our hearts a little bit more,
Yeah.
not just our minds. So let me ask you the final questions that I always ask. What do you have coming up next? What are you working on next?
Well, one thing, I have a course starting called Evocative Leadership Mastery. Actually, there's going to be two groups, one in Turkey and one in Spain. It starts at the end of October. And you can find out about that on my website, carlosphilipglover.com. I'm also wanting to give out the teachings in a kind of simple way for people to have little practices. So I'm doing YouTube videos, and you can find those as well. That's a couple of things I'm working on.
What is the name of the YouTube channel?
I think if you look at my name, I should know the name of my YouTube channel. Yeah, just look up Carlos Glover, but also Earth Wisdom Teachings. Those are the two things to really Google.
Yeah, and I know that on YouTube you have to have so many subscribers before they let you change the name. Otherwise, it's
Oh,
just
do they?
I forget what it is. I think maybe 500 or 1,000, maybe 500, or may not be
Right.
that many. It's been a while. But after a while they let you change it so it could be like YouTube slash Carlos Glover, you know.
Okay. Yeah. I think Earth Wisdom Teachings is probably the best thing to do.
All right, I will look into that and see if I can find it. So what I'll do is in the show notes and video description, I will put links for your book and for your personal website, and if I can, the YouTube channel as well. So, Carlos, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciated the conversation, and I am very grateful for the work that you're doing and putting it out there for people. I do highly recommend the book. I found it quite interesting. I love the approach that you took. I thought it was unique, and I always applaud anyone who is working towards healing humanity and healing the earth itself. So thank you.
Yeah, we need to do both. Nick, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and for all the listeners, blessings on your journey as well. And thank you so much for listening and for this conversation.
Well, thank you. Hopefully we can speak again at some time.
Yeah, I hope so.
That
Okay.
would be wonderful. All right. Well, thank you so much,
Thank you.
Carlos. All right.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And that's a wrap on episode 173 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, I know you know what's coming up next. Should be used to it by now, all the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media too, please, and subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the drill. I know you do. But the thing is, all of that is really important. Sharing, subscribing, and following are all free, and they really do help, and they only take a second of your time. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's been very slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now, doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology.
psychedelics and consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.